WNYC Studios is supported by the community of writers, presenting live online short courses in the Writer's Annex. Upcoming in 2024, Sylvia Plath, James Joyce's Ulysses, and Emily Dickinson. Instructors include Victoria Chang, Robert Haas, Brenda Hillman, Peter Orner, and Matthew Zapruder. Learn more at communityofwriters.org.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Someone when they have that revelation,
it's making sure
that maybe looking at this case, it could be an interesting process piece.
Okay.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The comedian Hannah Gadsby has a special coming out on Netflix this week. And it's her debut on American television, but it's also her farewell to comedy. And we'll find out why when she talks with Emily Nussbaum. And we'll see how it feels for one of the most formidable critics of fiction to put out a novel of his own. That's all ahead.
Hello?
Hey, Jane, how you doing?
Good, how are you?
Good.
Are we rolling? We are.
Great. Now, I've called up Jane Mayer because for years, Jane has been reporting on the political activities of the Koch brothers, Charles and David Koch of Koch Industries. They're among the biggest donors in conservative politics, spreading a free market and libertarian view of the world. And their influence in Washington can hardly be overstated. So Donald Trump's big pivot toward trade protectionism is the very last thing they want to see. Trump seems determined to spark a trade war, imposing tariffs not only on China and Mexico, but Canada and Europe too. Charles and David Koch have now launched a campaign against those policies, right as the midterm elections give voters a referendum on the Trump presidency. Jane, the Kochs have been free trade boosters for decades. How are they reacting to Trump's behavior at the G7 and his recent round of tariffs?
Well, they're against any kind of tariffs. They think that it's deleterious to their business and to the country's economy. So they're planning to spend a lot of money to oppose his policy of imposing tariffs. And so it's one of the areas that they differ from him on, and they know how to make a lot of noise when they need to. They'll spend as much money as they can.
How much are they spending on this anti-tariffs campaign?
They've talked about spending millions, maybe as much as $30 million.
And what form will the spending take? Can I spot a Coke advertisement on television if I look carefully?
You very well may be able to. Look for ads from Americans for Prosperity, and there are a number of other allied groups that they fund. They have a Hispanic group that they fund. They have a veterans group, Concerned Veterans for America. You'll see ads that will say that these tariffs are going to hurt poor people and consumers. They don't go out there and say these tariffs are going to hurt Koch Industries and we, who are the ninth richest men in America, which is what the two Koch brothers are. They talk about how the tariffs are going to hurt the little people.
Now, what does this mean for the midterm elections? Where are the Kochs going to put their money when it comes to November?
They are going to mostly do what they usually do, which is try to control Congress with their money. And so the most important for them is to keep the country from doing anything that would put a tax on carbon pollution and take action against global warming, because their whole business is tied up in carbon, in fossil fuels.
The party in power almost always loses some seats in a midterm. Where are they going to concentrate?
They're going to put a lot of money behind Republican candidates, and every now and then there'll be a Democrat. There are a few straggler Democrats that they have always funded. They're Democrats where they've got some of their businesses are located, like in Arkansas. They've backed Democrats in the past. And Democrats who support the policies that they support, they'll back. So they've done that recently with one who was supporting the gutting of the Dodd-Frank financial regulation bill. What they've been able to do is create an apparatus that's it's like a political machine. And there's a piece by a couple scholars at Harvard who describe it as a machine that is as powerful, if not more powerful, than the Republican Party at this point. And so what they do is they use this political muscle they've got to scare Republicans into following their agenda, and they threaten those that might not by saying, we'll run somebody against you in a primary. They call it, we'll primary you. And so the Republicans want to toe their line so that they don't have a primary opponent who's really well-funded who might knock them out. And most of the people on the Hill, face it, want to get reelected, so they go along.
Well, let's remind ourselves what the Kochs did during the election campaign. If I remember, they described the campaign of Clinton versus Trump as, you know, having to decide between a heart attack and cancer, I think is how they put it. Now they have Trump. Was tariffs the main reason that they thought this was a disease?
It's part of it. The truth is that they are radical right libertarians. They want to shrink the government down to, you know, the size that it was during Calvin Coolidge's period. Calvin Coolidge is their favorite president. And they realize that Trump is not one of them. He's not a libertarian. He's not an ideologue. He's a different kind of breed. He's not someone they can control particularly. He doesn't necessarily share their beliefs. And if anything, he kind of aggrandizes himself as president and makes a show of a display of power as president. That none of that is their kind of politics.
No, he's not Silent Cal. Trump is not Silent Cal. But they had to.
He is not Silent Cal.
But they had to know this was coming. This of all the positions that Trump has ever taken, the one he's been pretty clear about from the start is what he's doing now on trade, isn't it?
Well, right. And so this was one of the reasons they opposed him. They would have been happy with any of the other Republican nominees, potential nominees for president in 2016. And they were ready to back any of them except Trump. And they sat on their hands on the sidelines waiting for a nominee to be chosen. And then they were going to throw their money into the race. And lo and behold, the one guy who they opposed got the nomination.
Did they give money all the same?
They had set aside a kitty of $889 million. The money was distributed in lesser amounts to many, many Senate and congressional and gubernatorial and even lower level candidates. But they didn't put money behind Trump. But I actually feel that sort of obscures what, to me anyway, is the more important story, which is, yes, they have differences with him on trade and on immigration. Those are two major areas of difference they've got with him. But they've gotten behind him on so many other things quietly.
Like what?
Well, they are huge supporters of his one achievement in office legislatively, which is the tax bill that was passed recently. It reduces corporate rates from 35 to 21%. This is their idea of heaven. And they put $20 million into backing it in a national campaign, pushing to get it through Congress. And the other thing they did, which is really something that we're going to all be dealing with the consequences for years, is that they stopped him from achieving the mechanism that he had originally intended to pay for those tax cuts, which was something called the border adjustment tax. And Paul Ryan was for it. So you've got the Speaker of the House of Representatives. Trump was for it. You had the White House backing it. But guess what? The Kochs were against it and they killed it. So there's no mechanism now to make up for the gigantic deficits that the Trump tax bill is going to create. And they're going to create a lot more pressure to keep cutting government spending. And that's what the Kochs want.
Jane, my understanding is that while Donald Trump himself may be somewhat distant, especially ideologically, from the Kochs on certain issues, you've got Betsy DeVos, who's the Secretary of Education, Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, Mike Pence, who's the Vice President, obviously. They all have pretty close ties to the Kochs.
Really close ties.
So how have they been able to influence policy at, say, the Department of the Interior or the EPA, let's say?
Well, so in the Department of the Interior, there is the top lawyer there is a man named Daniel Giorgiani, who was, I mean, he's worked for many years for Charles Koch, for his institute, for his foundation, and for the Koch brothers' political organization. So he's just a kind of a right-hand man to Charles Koch, and he's now the top lawyer in the Interior Department. And over in the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, they've got the secretary is Scott Pruitt, who is somebody whose political career was funded from the start by the Kochs.
David Koch has stepped down. He's retired. Did he do so voluntarily, or did his brother give him a little kick out the door?
Well, I mean, the thing is, he's retiring because he's in failing health. And so it was somewhat
inevitable. But there was tension there, right?
Yes. But according to the two of the sources I talked to, who are very much in the know, he was given a push out the door by his older brother. And they said that it was done with a wink and a nod and a nudge, and that David Koch really hadn't wanted to go, but that Charles has been pushing him out for some time.
Regardless of what happens with trade policy or in November, isn't it your sense that the Kochs have come out pretty far ahead on these 2 years of the Trump presidency? They, despite their opposition on tariffs or immigration, they've gotten plenty out of this presidency.
I mean, really, tariffs and immigration are not such central questions to them as environmental policy and tax policy and other regulatory policy. And on those areas, Trump for them is a dream come true.
Jane, thanks so much.
Great to be with you.
Jane Mayer, staff writer at The New Yorker since 1995. Her book, Dark Money, is all about the Koch brothers' influence on American politics. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour, and if you're a college student or a new grad out there looking around for a job, we've got some tips on meeting the new boss.
When I'm in this office, watch out. I will tear your new one its own new one.
Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour.
All right, sit down. So, you think you got what it takes to be my intern?
Well, I think if you'll look at my resume, you'll find that I have...
Shut your idiot trap for a minute, Poindexter. Maybe you'll learn something. I'm not sure you realize I'm a broker at the top hedge fund in New York City. I kick ass, and I don't even take names. Why? Because I don't even give a shit about other people's names.
Well, if you just look at my resume, you'll see that my name is Paul...
When I'm in this office, watch out. I will tear your new one its own new one. But come the weekend, I cut loose. Turn into a goddamn room temperature green tea sipping craft show watching hardcore online Mahjong enthusiast. I'm not a shark. I'm a motherfucking orca. An orca who likes ending the day with a tall ice cold O'Doul's in the commemorative glass I got on a trip to an American Girl doll convention with my nieces. Hold on. I'm closing on a deal the size of an inferior country's GDP, and the SEC's been on my ass like John Wayne on a stallion. Daisy.
Yeah?
Be a doll and clear my evening and order up a couple of pounds of ribeye, because Daddy's going to be taking care of business and working overtime. And do me a favor, make sure you set my DVR for that marathon of the Great British Bake Off.
Already done.
Thank you.
So, did you want to look at my resume, maybe?
You got a problem with what I'm saying?
No.
I can buy and sell you 1,000 times over, and I'll be laughing all the way to my daily cognitive behavioral therapist appointment, punk, where Dr. Tesler and I work on using laughter as a means of assuaging social anxiety. Yeah, that's right. I got social anxiety, and lots of it. Now get the hell out of my office. It's almost lunch, and that's my scrapbooking time. And by the way, you're hired. Yeah, you heard me. Go see Linda in HR. Idiot.
I Work Hard and I Play Soft by Teddy Wayne. Performed for the New Yorker Radio Hour by Ed Helms. And I'm David Remnick. Writing a novel is a daunting piece of business. But for James Wood, there's an extra dimension to it all. Wood has been a literary critic at this magazine for a decade, and before that, at The New Republic and The Guardian. As a critic, he's alive to the infinite ways in which a book can go right or go flat. He's attuned to every detail of voice, point of view, and structure. But more than that, James has a certain reputation. He's exacting. Sometimes, when necessary, he's even been a little bit ruthless, some would say. He believes in the need for deep cultural argument, and if he makes an enemy along the way sometimes, so be it. The stakes are high, in other words. Maybe that's why it's been 15 years between James Wood's first novel and the new one. The book is called Upstate, and it's set in Saratoga Springs, New York, and it follows a father, an Englishman, spending time with his adult daughters, one of them an energetic corporate executive, the other a melancholy professor of philosophy. It's a meditation on what it means to be a parent and what it means to be a family.
Your critical sensitivity is incredibly acute. I mean, one of your great talents as a critic is to give a reading of a paragraph, of a passage, and break it down the way a musician would, the way a musician would go into 16 bars of music and take it apart and see what it's doing and how it's working, where it's mistaken, and all the rest. How do you go about your fictional life? You teach at Harvard. You, thank God, write essays for us. You do other things. You're easily the world's greatest drummer who also writes novels and literary criticism.
Hello, Bob, perhaps.
Well, yeah, but I must say, damn good. No kidding around. But how does fiction work in your day-to-day work life? Is it an event or is it the everyday thing?
No, it was definitely an event, and I think that's an explanation for why it's been 15 years since I last wrote a novel. It's an event that has to fit into making a living, being a parent, teaching, writing criticism. It's not to say that I didn't make a daily space for it. I tried to make a daily space for it, but the novel took me a long time because I would stop for months on end, actually, when there was, say, a big piece to write or when term time just got too much of a hassle. I would just sort of stop and say, okay, I don't do it until the summer. But that didn't bother me too much, actually, because of this mental image that was always going on, which was that...
What's the mental image?
The mental image was that... even when I wasn't writing it, I was writing it. The mental image was that every single piece I wrote for the magazine or book I taught to the students at Harvard, however sort of irksome or ordinary, seemed to be teaching me something. I've always felt that, actually.
Now, this book, I would think, comes in large measure out of the death of your mother. The event of it, the image of it, the desire to write about it in some ways. Can you tell me a little bit about how that works? In other words, the event in life and then how it starts developing into a work of art in your mind.
Yeah, my mother died in 2014. And as happens when a parent dies, you reflect on a whole life, but you also reflect on quality of parenting that made you who you are. My mother was a very complicated creature. And I have to say that I feel as a lucky middle child that I got the best of it. That's to say, when I wrote a piece for the magazine about my mum, my sister who read it was in furious disagreement because her idea of my mother was of a much more hostile, much more abusive, much angrier person than mine. But where my sister and I would agree is that my mother was a depressive. And her mother, my grandmother, had some sort of nervous breakdown in the 20s or 30s, and I actually allude to this in the novel and had electroconvulsive therapy. So when my mother died, I was naturally reflecting on a certain legacy of happiness and unhappiness in our family that flowed from her. And then when you add to that one's own experience as a parent, how little one can actually control, it turns out, in the lives of one's children, and the awful thought that happiness might be one of those things one can't materially affect very much, that much more is determined perhaps by, you know, DNA or by birth order or by the vagaries of personality and temperament, than anything one can actually do as a parent. So that was really what was really the germ of this novel, was thinking about the apparently arbitrary distribution of happiness and unhappiness in families.
At one point in your novel, your main character, Alan, says the following, that extraordinary power family had to blot out all other considerations, all other desires and dissatisfactions. Perhaps he'd feared that, recognized its engrossing fanaticism. If you surrender to that, you would do nothing else in life, build nothing else. How have you experienced that tension?
That's pretty much me speaking right out.
I guessed that.
I'll put it this way. I now understand, and have done for a few years, why traditionally female writers were so wary of having children and why canonically so many didn't. There's no doubt that it is a rival engrossment to, say, the writing life.
That men opt out of, or?
I mean, traditionally, I think men did, and they don't now, which is why you're getting actually some writing by men at last about fatherhood, whether it's Knausgård or Chabon or whatever. And it's not surprising. I mean, it's not just that it's rival creation and rival creativity. It's also, of course, the fact that having a child presents you with a limited and a feasible set of projects and goals and, you know, things that, do you know what I mean? It's dullish, but very easy for me to drive my son to endless soccer games. And it's somewhat enjoyable. And it's probably more enjoyable than sitting down to write something.
Is it? It's more enjoyable than pushing the rock up the hill.
Yeah, I don't actually like writing much.
Why?
I feel I'm going to fail each time I do it. I guess I just, each sentence is, there's too much of an ordeal of choice around each sentence.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean?
I do.
And there's no ordeal of choice around the fact that you have a daughter and a son, right? You just, that's it. It's what you were given and you made and you...
And yet you're no less bound to fail in that
absolutely,
endeavor too.
Absolutely right.
Do you cast yourself with, do you stake your claim with any certain living novelist now and say, I'm with her or him and I'm not with him or her?
Hmm.
Earlier in your career, you had a tendency to write a little bit more in that vein as a critic, you know,
yeah.
about hysterical realism or whatever it was. I'm for this tendency. I'm not with that tendency.
Yeah.
To some degree.
I don't think my taste has changed. My desire to prosecute wars has changed a bit. A militancy has gone. And I'm interested in opening up areas of literature to readers at the moment. But I don't think my taste has changed. I'm still reasonably hostile to, fantasy and the fantastic, although I'm really working hard to, you know, I'm doing my best. But I'm reasonably hostile to that and always have been. Even as a kid, I was never a kid who really liked comics and stuff like that.
George Martin is not your thing.
It's not my thing.
Yeah.
I'm reasonably hostile to the thing I dubbed hysterical realism years and years ago, and I don't like...
Maybe you should define it.
So a certain kind of... This is very tendentious, but I describe it as a certain kind of somewhat unsubtle comedy in which the fiction is semaphoring to the reader that comic and zany and wild events are taking place.
So this exemplified by what novels or writers?
So the books I was writing about when I put the boot in for hysterical realism were Zadie Smith's White Teeth, though that was a review of White Teeth, and it was also a very positive review of what I liked about White Teeth, which is obvious to any reader. Tremendous energy, a comic exuberance that you don't want to diminish, but whose tendencies I wanted, as a critic, I wanted it to change a little bit, I guess. Salman Rushdie's The Ground Beneath Her Feet.
The rock and roll novel.
The rock and roll novel. David Foster Wallace's Infinite Jest. Pynchon's Mason and Dixon. And parts of DeLillo's Underworld. Not, I think, the great last 150 pages where he's sort of revisiting his childhood in the Bronx, but again, some of this is about, I think, just talking personally, some of this for me is I really like subtlety in fiction. So you know what I'm talking about. Everyone who's ever read a page of David Foster Wallace knows that there's a kind of level of genius there which is not to be gainsaid.
That you acknowledge.
Absolutely. I teach at Harvard brief interviews with hideous men each year because it's a book I admire. But when Wallace is being an ironist, he tends to underline all his ironies, right? I mean, he literally italicizes them. Or he footnotes them. It seems to me that if you're going to be ironic, you should be subtle about your irony because that's a sort of a definition of irony, right?
You're saying it's too cartoonish for you.
Yeah, I like hidden irony rather than blatant irony.
You used a great phrase, prosecuting wars, and I'll let the listeners into a little secret. When you made the jump from the New Republic,
yeah.
to The New Yorker, your editor at The New Republic, Leon Wieseltier, basically said, he was quite disappointed, let's say, that you were leaving, and I don't blame him, but that you might go soft because somehow The New Yorker is not a place for prosecuting wars. And in fact, you said, I'm not going to go soft. Do you feel that you have a little bit, or is that a matter of age or a matter of publication? Or something else?
what I'd say is I don't like the language anymore of I won't go soft. I think that was the wrong way to talk about it, and I shouldn't have done in 2007.
What's the better way to put it?
I will expand.
Because it seems to me, and your editor here is Henry Finder, especially lately, in the last, at least the last 3 years, very often the project, at least it seems to me, is here's this new thing I knew nothing about, I'm enthusiastic about it, and I want you to know too. That was quite different than what you tended to do certainly 15 years ago.
Yes. So instead of saying in 2007 I won't go soft, I should have said I won't stay in the same trench. I won't stay in the same rut. There was a tendency to repeat. I mean, this is the awful thing about prosecuting wars is that you tend to fight the same ones.
Not many literary critics have written fiction, at least recently. I mean, Edmund Wilson did. There are others. How do you fit this into your writing life? What role does it play in your writing life, imaginative life?
I think I have to admit that I'm your sort of nightmare critic cliche. So that's to say, I'm one of those critics who has always been writing ghost novels, always wanted to write fiction, much more than I ever wanted to write criticism. Feel that the last 30 years has been a peculiar diversion from my ambition. So I'm definitely not in the camp of, you know, critic can't, critic merely teaches, artist does the real thing. I guess when I'm writing fiction, I don't actually turn off the critical monitor either.
Is that a good thing or a problem?
I think it can be a problem. There's this wonderful phrase that V.S. Pritchett used about Ford Madox Ford. He clearly didn't rate Ford quite as high as, you know, Proust or whatever, and said Ford never fell into that determined stupor out of which great work comes.
It's a great phrase.
It's a wonderful phrase. And we all know what he means. There's a certain kind of, you have to put something to sleep. You have to put some sort of monitor to sleep, I think. And there's a romantic version of it, which is, you know, staying up for four nights running and just, you know, living on inspiration. Occasionally, while writing this novel, I felt that I'd put the critical monitor to sleep, and those were the moments when I truly didn't know where I was going. Those are the moments where artists of all kinds talk about, you know, they use these sort of metaphors of transport, of being taken somewhere, of not knowing where they were going, of being told something by their characters. That occasionally happened. But more often than not, for better or worse, I was still the critic. And I guess I've consoled myself that that critical ability has its virtues too when you're writing fiction. Obviously enough, all writers are critics in the sense that we all have to edit and improve and chuck stuff out and do all that.
Now, you're across the kitchen table from a novelist every day. Claire Massoud, a terrific novelist. So you have two critics, two novelists in the house, and two bodies. You read each other, and what is it like to read your wife's manuscript, and what do you say and what not?
Yeah, it's a perilous activity, I have to say, perilous for the happiness of our household.
How honest are you?
I'm about 80% honest. But of course, I want her to be 100% honest with me.
So I say.
I'm her first reader when she's finished her manuscript. She was the first reader of Upstate and tremendously helpful, I have to say. I mean, she brought a novelist's eye to it and said, you know, there's a couple of strands here that you've lopped off too soon and they need to be extended right to the end of the book, particularly because it's a short book. It needs to have that sense of being well wrought. She was great. But you have to hold back a little bit.
With Shalom Bayit, peace
exactly.
in the household.
Exactly.
James, thank you so much for coming by.
It's a real pleasure
to see you. James Wood's new book is called
upstate. And he's writing about fiction all the time at The New Yorker. And you can find it, of course, at newyorker.com.
Coachella.
Backstage at Lollapalooza.
Pitchfork Music Festival.
Bonnaroo, this song is for you, Bonnaroo.
Chicago, y'all ready to see the Migos?
Summer means, among other things, outdoor music festivals all across the country, by the hundreds, in every genre you could possibly name. Where thousands of mostly young people pack their sweaty selves onto huge fields to listen to band after band after band, and all the while trying to avoid heat stroke. Keeping up on top of the summer festivals is a job for music critic Amanda Petrusich, and better her than me. You know what's nice at a concert? A chair. A nice chair.
Maybe I like a freshly mixed martini.
I like, even a cold beer would be just a thing.
For me, it's the bathrooms. It's the porta potties, like the, you know, plastic kind of coffin effect.
And also the kind of sweat box aspect mixing well. It's just a great combination.
I don't know why people aren't inviting us to their festivals, because we're a great time.
Now, Amanda, despite all this propaganda from me, you've come to tell us about some great festivals this summer.
If anyone is still
where
listening.
Where and when and how.
My first pick is called Pickathon, and it is a festival that's held every summer in Happy Valley, Oregon, just outside of Portland. The UK independent newspaper has called it the most hipster event on the planet.
I'm so there.
The stages kind of double as art installations. Every attendee gets one plate and one cup that you reuse for the entire weekend.
So this is not Beyonce topping the bill.
No, I mean, one of the cool things, or another cool thing I should say about Pickathon is that most of these festival, the big summer festival lineups, they're all the same. You know, it's like the same sort of big money-making acts. Right. Pickathon is great in that I think the curation is a little more idiosyncratic. It's a roots music festival, so they tend to be sort of folksier bands or bands with whom you can sort of have a real kind of intimate connection. It's a little bit less spectacle and maybe a little smaller, even though the festival itself is pretty big.
It sounds fun.
Yeah, I hope so. But there are two artists playing this year that I'm super excited about, both of whom are Pickathon veterans. And the first is a folk band from Toronto called The Weather Station. Mm-hmm. So why don't we listen to a little bit?
There was a time you put your hand on the small of my back. I was surprised that you touched me like that. But there in your hand was a current of life I could hardly stand. Or stay still, and I didn't imagine it. If I did, I'd have made some joke of it. It was strange how I could feel so sane, so plain.
We were listening to Tamara Lindemann singing. She was a television star in Canada prior to kind of dedicating herself to music full time. But I like that her voice is sort of delicate, it's vulnerable, but she has a real edge to her too. And her lyrics, I think, can be, they're really sort of sharply observed and interesting.
Who else is playing in Oregon?
The second is a band of Tuareg musicians from Mali called Tanariwen. It's really sort of mesmeric and beautiful, and for me they're the kind of band that you actually want to hear outside under the stars with a zillion other people around.
Okay, so we've left Oregon. Where are we going now?
My second pick will surely get me accused of collusion. And my accusers will be right, because I've written for Pitchfork for many years. And my second pick is the Pitchfork Music Festival.
That's fair enough.
Which is in Grant Park in Chicago in July. But I will say, I think the lineup this year is extraordinary. And in particular, I'm incredibly excited about a young singer and songwriter from West London named Nilufer Yanya. She's released 3 EPs, has yet to release her debut record.
Throw it all away for you. Just like you asked me.
but I think she makes this sort of nonchalant but really deeply felt guitar pop that's sort of heavy and beautiful. And she's only playing a handful of U.S. dates this summer. She's opening for Fleet Foxes. The Pitchfork Music Festival is one of them. Another chance I can count on you to take your time. And boy, I'm getting tired of your games. You just don't stop speaking, but I'm done with feeling. Pitchfork also has Lauryn Hill and Chaka Khan on Sunday night, so it's going to be, I think, a pretty epic weekend. I am afraid my last pick is going to scare you off because it's a little new agey. Okay. And I'm afraid you're going to make fun of
me. A little Wyndham Hill?
A bit, yes. Yeah, okay. It is. But I promise you, no crystals, no tinctures, no scarves. My third pick is a concert series called Sonic Seasonal, which takes place at the Chestnut Hill Quaker Meeting House in Philadelphia, which is also the home to a James Turrell sky space. So there is a lovely light installation in this space. And they book a different artist for every season of the year. And the summer booking is a harpist named Mary Lattimore. Just released her fourth record.
I'm there. So when Joanna Newsom brought the harp back into pop music, I was so dubious, and she's a kind of genius, so
I think that you will dig what Mary's doing too. It's, you know, it's a harp, but she's, you know, she does some kind of strange and difficult and provocative things with it. It's not just all sort of, you know, hotel lobby cocktail reception. And I think in this space it will be really, really beautiful.
Amanda, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Staff writer Amanda Petrusich, recommending Sonic Seasonal in Philadelphia, the Pitchfork Festival in Chicago, and Pickathon in Oregon. You're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from the New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
I'm David Remnick, and this is the New Yorker Radio Hour. The comedian Hannah Gadsby is very big in Australia. She's a headliner at the Melbourne Comedy Festival, and she's a regular at the International Edinburgh Fringe Festival. Gadsby is about to become a very big deal in America with a special on Netflix called Nanette. Nanette is a full-length comedy show and at the same time a critique of stand-up comedy that's serious and even profound. The New Yorker's Emily Nussbaum went to see Nanette, performed in New York, and she says that Gadsby had her audience laughing and crying and sometimes dead silent.
I first saw Hannah Gadsby in a fantastic Australian television show called Please Like Me. In it, she played a depressed but intensely charming young woman named Hannah, a character who was based a little bit on her and a little bit on Hannah's work as a stand-up comedian. She's developed a new hour-long stand-up show pretty much every year. Hannah's latest show is something very different. it's a masterful critique of stand-up comedy, and it's a strikingly relevant presentation and a challenging one for audiences in the age of Me Too. It's also hilarious, and it might make you cry.
I've built a career out of humiliating myself and putting myself down in order to seek permission to speak, to take up space in the world. And I have decided I don't want to do that anymore. I will not do that anymore. Not to myself. Oh, thank you. I mean, don't worry, I'm not starting a rally. I'll finish the show as a comedy. But thank you.
Hannah's show is very carefully structured, doing different things to the audience at different points, soothing them, making them tense, engaging them, shocking them. There are stories that weave through the show. They start out as jokes, and Gadsby gradually unfolds them like a paper fortune teller to reveal that they aren't jokes at all. They're very serious stories about prejudice, power, and assault, but they're never polemical or simply pedantic. They have complicated, unsettling things to say about the kinds of relationships that people have with one another. Hannah told me that early on in her career, her outsider status, in many different ways, helped her to be funny.
I'm a very difficult human to categorize. Like, I'm a larger woman. I'm from Tasmania, which is the small state in Australia. And I'm a lesbian. And these come with stereotypes that I subvert. You know, Tasmanians are supposed to be stupid, but I'm quite cerebral, so I don't play to that. And then also with my being overweight, I'm not jolly. I don't make fun of my weight. And then lesbian, which means you're very angry. This is when I started particularly. I mean, of course, that's opened up a lot more. Mm-hmm. And I'm quite a gentle, sensitive. So that really, you know, helped me early in my career because, this, you know, when you disrupt, that's instant tension. So that's actually handy. But as my career evolved, it became a real block.
Right.
And ultimately, what this show is, and I don't say it in the show at all. I don't make any reference to it at all, but essentially this show is about having autism and a late diagnosis. And so instead of saying, this is what I have, I decided to show what this brain can do, which is a real clear acknowledgement of how emotion works and how I feel it.
It's really fascinating because I actually was thinking that is one of the most powerful things about the show is that I've seen cerebral comedy shows and I've seen emotive ones, and it is both a cerebral and a deeply emotional show. And that combination is a very potent thing. And one of the things that's just beautiful in the show is that you explain the limits of stand-up while you're doing stand-up. And so you do this kind of seductive magician revealing their trick thing. So you make the audience self-conscious of the power that goes back and forth. So we're going to play just a little clip of a section of the show in which you talk about how comedy works, how jokes work.
Oh, let me tell you what a joke is. If I boil it down to its absolute bare components, a joke simply needs two things, a setup and a punchline. That's all it needs. And it works in the same way as a question and answer. Right? You ask a question, the anticipation is the tension, and the answer diffuses the tension. But with a joke, the answer is a surprise. So you laugh. So you, I wasn't expecting that. There you go, lesson over. It's an easy job. I'll be replaced. No, everybody will miss me. But what a joke is in this situation is a question that I've just artificially inseminated with tension. And then, and that's all I do. Like, I manipulate it. Like, I make you tense, then I make you laugh over and over again. And you're like, oh, thank you. I was feeling a bit tense. But fucking hell, guys. I'm making you tense over and over again. This is an abusive relationship.
I love that part because it's a very deep insight, but it also has this dirty joke in it. Your bigger point that you're making, though, is that there's something harmful about jokes, and there's something harmful specifically about stopping at the punchline, like the perpetual stopping at the punchline. Can you describe a bit what you think that harm is?
It's the harm of the joke is the only reason to speak. The point is only to make people laugh. And that troubled me after a while because I've always told stories, and that whole idea that laughter is the best medicine is not what I believe in. I believe laughter is the honey that sweetens the medicine story, really.
Mm-hmm. We have a long history. You to listen to the story.
Yeah.
Like, here you're talking about storytelling as a psychological tool, one we use to understand our own experiences by turning them into narratives.
And it's about also the live experience, because stand-up comedy has the potential to be such an amazing cultural gift, because it is one of the rare occasions where a group of strangers get to sit in a room sharing an experience. And I think that is a very potent human thing to have. But I really think, I really am passionately concerned that story gets downplayed and dismissed. Because what art is, any art, it's not special, it's story. And stories are brilliant and they're wonderful and they're so important. But a story really does, in the traditional sense, need three parts: a beginning, a middle, and an end. And the end, the third part, is so important. And that is what elevates you. Right? That's where catharsis lives. That's where hindsight sits. That's where you get to look back through a narrative with the perspective, wisdom, and experience of someone other than yourself. Comedy doesn't do that. We stop short. Set up, punchline, beginning, middle. There it sits. And it's a very good reason it's called a punchline, is because it deals with tension, hence it feeds trauma. We need tension in the room in order to get a laugh. But then we don't sort it out after. We just leave it there. This is like all these comedians going up and down the country triggering people and getting all confused. It's like, whoa, and it's like, yeah, because you just keep saying the same thing and it hurts.
So there's an ongoing debate about what is and what is not an acceptable joke. For instance, is a joke about rape ever actually funny? Is it okay to make a genocide gag? Chris Rock has this idea that if people laugh, it means it's funny. Like, you disagree with that, I would assume, right?
I do.
Yeah.
I've been in the audiences and I've laughed at horrific things. I've also stood side of stage while comedians are doing material I find absolutely horrific. Making people believe violence against women is funny. And I hear audiences laughing. And I don't think that they would want to. You know, you can make anyone laugh if you make them tense enough because they want to get rid of the tension.
So about 20 minutes into Nanette, the show shifts. And you tell personal stories on stage. A lot of it has to do with painful and traumatic personal experiences. I was wondering how it felt on stage for you when you were first forming the show to have people crying or silent. Like, what did you're a person who's used to getting laughs. Like, what was that like for you as a performer?
Strictly what I was doing there is I was using one of the best tools in a particularly longer form comedy show, and that's a callback. And it works on the premise of a shared joke. In comedy, often I do, that's what I do. Like I, you know, work through an hour stand-up and eventually we have shared jokes. And I love that. They make an average joke brilliant. In this show, I subverted that. I used a callback to drop them into a huge hole and not give them the laugh. So to go against my instinct was really incredibly hard. To not break the tension. Real palpable silences in the show, and my instinct as a comic is to make people feel better and make them laugh. So that was difficult in the first. And also, I was getting really horrific heckles in the first.
I was wondering, did people heckle you?
Yeah, because now there's no room, because it's really tight now. But when I first was doing it, there was a lot of room. The structure was different. And, you know, it was always guys. And always after I just told my audience that I'd been sexually assaulted, always at that point.
That's amazing
to me. Yeah. And so then I'd get mansplaining from the audience.
I have to say, having seen the show, which is a very, like, and you really do have control over the audience, like you sort of critique the control back and forth. So people would shout cruel, insulting things to you?
So this has evolved. This control has evolved pretty much out of that because I'm like, well, I don't want this to happen. I can't keep doing this show if this is going to happen. So I learned from that, but it was really devastating because when I do that, when I am genuinely vulnerable and it is violence, it felt like violence to get heckled at those moments. But I think I really learned from that and was like, gosh, that is violence. And that's what comedy promotes. And so it really drove the show toward a more technical show because I wanted to show people what that is, that violence, and what it feels like.
Well, you're obviously an extremely technically adroit stand-up comic. Are there specific skills that you've picked up from doing this different kind of show?
No. This is a showcase almost. What's interesting about the show is I'm high status. I've never been that in a show. But I discovered that voice doing – I had to do a spin-off at some festivals where I do comedy art lectures. I've done one on the Virgin Mary, the one on the nude and modern.
Just to clarify, you have an art history background.
Yes. Sorry. And when I did those shows, I discovered I was had more authority. I could talk about interesting things and there wasn't that resistance going, where's my laugh, which you get in comedy. So this is the first comedy show that I've played higher status. And
authoritative.
Whereas before I would just be, you know.
This is actually a great part for us to play this other clip that is actually partially about art and partially about an incredibly timely subject, sexual trauma, misogyny, art, and the Me Too movement.
Honestly, I can draw a straight line from Pablo Picasso to Donald Trump by way of Roman Polanski, Woody Allen, Louis C.K., Bill Cosby. They're all cut from the same fucking cloth, and I'm sick of it. These men control our stories. They control our stories, yet they have a diminishing connection to their own humanity. What the fuck are we doing? Hindsight is a gift. Unwrap it! I keep getting told, just separate the man from the art. You've got to separate the man from the art. All right, grow up. Calm down. Don't get emotional. It's art. You've got to separate the man from the art. How about I don't? I will not separate the man from the art. And even if I did, the shit sticks.
See, I gotta say, I loved this part of the show. It was also the part that, because I'm an arts critic, was the most challenging to me because it is the thing that I have been wrestling so much in the people who've influenced me, the people that I've written about. I have my own ambivalent relationship. Are there artists that are basically like shitty guys who've done bad things that are important influences on you? What do you do with that stuff once you don't separate it?
I believe, art is important. I don't believe artists are important as individuals. My favorite comedian's been Bill Cosby, always. He's funny. I like his rhythm. I liked what he talked about. But I found it very easy to let go of him, very easy. I don't feel easy listening to his comedy anymore, but I'd be lying if I said it didn't influence me. But I let go of the man.
That makes a lot of sense. Has telling your own story every night changed how you see your story?
Yes. I am reliving trauma every night. And I'm not a trained performer, so I don't know how to do that protecting myself. But because it's such a vulnerable show for me, I don't know what I've done to myself with this show. Like, I've spoken to psychiatrists and people who, research trauma, and they don't know what I've done with this show. Reliving trauma over and over again. There's a fair chance I've done some neurological rewiring. And that's a part of a longer game in my comedy career anyway. Doing comedy, and particularly the longer form, hour-long shows, has meant that I've interrogated my own story. I needed to find a better, hindsight. You can't change what's happened. You can't repress what's happened, but you can find a more constructive hindsight. But also the added bonus is what I felt is that I'm more connected to the world than I've ever been, because my idiosyncratic story I thought was going to seal me off into the margins. But so many different types of people have connected into different parts of that show that it's actually been very constructive in a broader sense. And that's what doing this show has done for me, absolutely.
Comedian Hannah Gadsby talking with The New Yorker's Emily Nussbaum. Gadsby's show Nanette premieres on Netflix this week. I'm David Remnick, and that's it for today. Thanks for being with us, and if you've enjoyed the show, I just want to remind you can subscribe to the podcast and catch up on anything you missed. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, Sarah Nix, Mythili Rao, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Susan Morrison, Emma Allen, Michelle Moses, Emily Mann, and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
Support for today's show comes from Deloitte. What does the future look like? By melding business acumen and innovative technology, Deloitte can help you build the future only you can imagine. They can help engineer solutions for your business reality today and your vision for tomorrow to get you to a world where you don't just dream it, you build it. See how you can engineer advantage with Deloitte at deloitte.com/us/engineeringadvantage.